steadily, as a bubble on the air becalmed, that brilliant globule floated, gradually falling in the center of that vast concourse of worshippers. Down, slowly down, enlarging as it fell, it gained still greater brilliancy by expansion. I watched it with bated breath, wondering when we should sound the depth of itself, inspiring awe, until, at length bursting with a soft detonating chime, it threw a proportion of its crystal spray on every head within that audience, which lingered through that service like a jewel sent to flash God's blessing upon his children gathered there. The echoes of that soft percussion remained while that vast concourse took their seats, bearing the bright insignia of the presence of their Father, who waited to hear and answer prayer. 7 bars of silence intervened, and then the opening strains of the first chorus fell upon my ears. The theme commenced with a pianissimo number in unison of male magnetisms, for in all the chorale there was not one articulate sound. I looked, and from the heads of the men saw crimson rays emitting, which darting towards the center of the dome blended with each other, formed into circles of various sizes, and began to gyrate in the room. The movements caused vibrations of deeper or higher tones, according to the size of each circle and the speed with which it moved. The effect of this blending of the bass and tenor was like the muffled music of the ocean's roll when heard from some distant inland hill. The melody was too sweet to set to words without detracting from its cadence, and yet, as I listened to its holy inspiration, its greatest charm being the perfect unison of such diverse nations, religions, and tongues, I felt that heaven had accomplished a triumph in the setting to such music the immortal poem of Israel's sweetest singer, and that I was listening to a challenge to earth and heaven to behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. The invitation issued, and the gamut of their variations being exhausted, the circles ceased their flight, met, embraced, and finally spread themselves as a canopy across the dome. Then succeeded a duct of the blue and amber offerings of the youths and maidens, rising in the volume of its gradual crescendo, the sweeps of blue soprano and curves of amber contralto waking sweet echoes with the declaration - it is like the precious ointment upon the head, that ran down under the beard, even to Aaron's beard, that went down to the skirts of his garment. At this point the women joined their rose-tinted pulse, throbs of a second soprano to swell the trio - as the dew of Hermon, and as the dew which descended upon the mountains of Zion. Then the full chorus pealed, 1,000 children contributing the brilliance of their untinted music, as the canopy of circles re-formed, and moved to lend their deep foundation to the strain. It sounded like a choir of angels singing, with the voice of far distant thunders, and heaven's own burden serving as a double bass to the orchestra of the ocean's roll. All harmonies, above, beneath, around, with all the chords and voices nature can command, being represented in the universal confirmation - for the Lord commanded his blessing, even life forevermore. The chorus swelled around us with such majestic force and intensity that every color flashed its echo to enhance the glory, until the hall was bathed with the perfume of thanksgiving, then gathering over the arena. As the final beat of the last bar was reached, a harmony of shades as sweet as that of sound was formed, and the cloud ascended as an offering of gratitude for our Father's love. The dome was not yet clear of that prismatic cloud before a chord of even sweeter music fell upon our ears, and I perceived that the jewels on our heads were chiming the acceptance and Amen of God. Up to this point Kushner had assumed the directorship from the center of the arena, being surrounded by a number of young men and women who moved in graceful order with the rhythm of the music, as if engaged in working out some figure in a mystic dance. On making inquiry I was informed that this chorus was but an introduction to the ceremony, sung to aid those special attendants in producing a suitable magnetic condition into which to introduce the patients, and looking intently in obedience to the wish of my instructor, I saw that all the magnetisms had not ascended, some had been distilled, shall I say etherealized? And filled the arena like the least suspicion of a cloud, and yet, it was not cloud, since such a designation conveys the idea of an unsubstantial vapor which could have been carried hence upon the arms of motion. This had weight and body through which the attendants moved to and fro as bathers move through shallow water, with the exception that this scarcely visible something seemed to offer no resistance. Here is a metaphor which will convey the idea of what it seemed to be. It was like the specter of the lake, which in its restless wanderings had been conjured to pause for a time, that the spirits of some children of mortality might bathe therein, and wash the last traces of the earth away. My attention was here called to a man who entered the hall from the corridor through which I came. His tall and stalwart form was clothed in a robe of electric grey, over which he wore a flowing mantle of blue, lined with amber and gorgeously embroidered from his loins downwards. His face, complexion, and general bearing reminded one of an Arab sheikh, except that haughtiness was here replaced by calm humility. Around his head, waist, wrists, and ankles he wore circlets of some strange amalgam, set with gems that emitted rays of light, thereby forming six circles of halo, which invested him with some mysterious power. As he stepped into the arena, a flash of welcome greeted him from that immense assembly. He glanced round the hall, just as a skilled conductor will survey his orchestra to see if all is ready for the baton's wave. Reaching the point where Kushner awaited him, he merely bowed his head, at which the attendants turned and left the hall by the passage at which he had entered. Here I took the opportunity to ask, "Who is this?" "Siamts, the magnetic adept who will conduct the chorale." "An Oriental, I presume?" "Assyrian." We had no time for further conversation. Scarcely had that single word been spoken before the Assyrian raised his hand, as if to call his audience to attention. For an instant it remained poised, while a luminous sea, green cloud enveloped it, then with a majestic sweep he struck a circle, throwing the halo in the air above him. A pause, and then another sweep repeated again and yet again, each motion adding another circle to expand and follow its predecessor. Only a pulse throb marked the interval between each beat, but that was long enough to change the color, as he desired to change the note to form that bugle call with which he summoned his army to march to victory. The challenge had not died away before a jubilant response was floating in the air. It was a marshal's train, and one could almost fancy they heard the steady and measured tramp of the approaching battalions as they came in the strength and confidence of their cause to certain triumph. The gentle crescendo grew in force and volume as each succeeding wave of magnetism rolled into the expanse above us. Their form was no longer circle and curve and flash, as in the opening chorus, but following the example of the Assyrian, each contribution came in vapory strains to form the novel harmonies of that theme. Waves of primrose and blue met and kissed each other into the life chord for which they had been born, then blended in their next development to form the glory. Green of hope, clouds of crimson strength from men took to their embraces the white purity of the children's love, and nursed them into tones of sympathy, then each one yielding to the other, united in the pink of charity. Brown and rose, mauve and cerise, auburn and grey, green and gold washed over each other, embraced and eddied round, as each produced the note desired. And having thus achieved the first purpose of existence, they added to their music the perfume of duty faithfully fulfilled, until the air was weighted with fragrant sounds, changing in volume and in kind with every chord and combination. At length the hall itself was full, perfume was crushing color and color crowding sound, but that grand march of life seemed only half complete. Again the adept raised and swept his hand, this time throwing into the transparent clouds around us variegated sparks bright with electric glow, like jewels flashing in the sun. An instant's pause, during which the magnetism of that host changed the form of its appearance, then perfume, sound and color were supplemented by a myriad gems giving still greater beauty to the fairy-like scene. At length from head of Siamts a rainbow signal flashed, and the strain's music gradually died away. But fragrance, light and color still remained. While this was proceeding, the attendants carried the patients in. Very tenderly was the service rendered, for Kushner was careful in the assignation and arrangement of each couch upon which they were laid, as if they had been the subjects of excruciating pain, rather than lying in a state of unconsciousness, for whom he was anxious to exhaust his resources to mitigate their suffering. When the last couch had received its occupant, a signal was given, and the music ceased. At this time the hall was like a sea of variegated colors, a magic, incomparable sea, with its now motionless depths illumined by a million fairy lamps, a sea in which a mighty host lay engulfed, overwhelmed with joy and calm content. Well might it be so, for, oh, the life, increasing life, which found its birth therein. Its waters were allowed to rest, that they might softly bathe those sleepers with life's fullness, and re-engraft the existence which seemed to flicker in its disasters and catastrophes through which their past has led them. The practiced eye of the Assyrian attentively watched the progress of each patient as the energizing powers around them were absorbed and assimilated, until returning strength began to show itself, and the inoculation had produced its needed change. When he was satisfied, throwing his mantle back across his shoulders with a kingly gesture, he raised his arms and waved them to and fro as a monarch would sway his scepter, in confidence that some pre-command would be obeyed. The effect was talismanic. Those mysterious forces immediately assumed intelligence, understood his sign, and hastened to obey. By the operation of some mystic law, each color was divided from the rest, some being changed into forms of fruit or flowers, others, weaved into semblances of brocades of silk and plush and satin, were draped in graceful folds as decorative hangings upon the walls, further ornamented and embroidered with a multitude of gems, which flashed their luster from the borders. Others, again, were woven into triumphal banners or emblems, with which the dome, arena, and seats were dressed, while the offering of the children, worked into lace of spotless purity, was gathered into festoons and valances to finish the decorations. Thus, by the simple act of the Assyrian's will, was the whole transformed and arrayed, as if for some thanksgiving or welcome home, when a nation meets to honor the return of an exiled chief or king. As he spread his hands to heaven, every knee around him bent in adoration. I knew it, though my eyes were fixed on him who, facing me, looked like a gladiator preparing for the contest, confident of victory, though death itself should be his adversary. Yet he was not proud or arrogant. All his majesty of mien, the glory of his strength, the perfection of his form, seemed to him unknown or, rather, for the moment were forgotten, and nothing but the child-like heart remained as he addressed his God. His thoughts flew upwards, like spasms of earth, engendered lightning flying towards the sun, pure and untinted by any shade of color. They were directed to the great supreme, and nothing but unsullied purity can gain admission to that sacred presence. Was there a quiver in their early flight? I do not know, but if so, it was due to the intense earnestness of the soul which poured its libations forth. Still no words, but in the sylvan music I thought I could comprehend the burden of his heart. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness, and the power, and the glory, and the victory, and the majesty. All that is in the heavens and the earth is thine. Thine are all kingdoms, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head over all. Both riches and honor come of thee, and in thine hand is power and might, and in thine hand it is to make great and to give strength unto all. Now, therefore, O Father, we thank thee, and praise thy glorious name. His prayer was done, there was no supplication. His confidence and faith declared that to be unnecessary. The presence of that host around him was a more eloquent and acceptable supplication than he could frame. God requires no superfluities. He was but the representative of the many, who desired to gain a victory over a hitherto triumphant wrong, and he was but the chosen champion for the combat. Stripped for the fray, he paused to lay his weapons at the feet of him for whose glory he was about to fight, to thank his king for the use of such victorious arms, and then to await the royal sign to strike. He was there to break the bands of captivity, to give freedom to the slave, and in his eye the assurance of triumph shone. His victory was already won in the confidence he possessed. His steady gaze still rested on that vaulted dome. He knew the answer would not tarry, and when it came it should find him waiting to receive it. A deeper hush fell over us, and then a cloud of glory, like a mantle of sunshine, descended, making him radiant with the power and presence of God. No need to wait longer when clothed with such authority and sanction. He approached a couch upon which lay a young woman deformed almost past recognition of the human form. She had appliances to nearly every part of her body, not fitted help or render support, but rather to torture and force her in dwarfish and unnatural shapes. The eyes had been purposely turned to make her sight uncertain, while her limbs were so pressed and malformed in order to prevent the possibility of unaided movement. Let it be here distinctly remembered that this deformity was spiritual, but to my astonishment at that time, confirmed by later and considerably extended experience, I found that in the persons of these recent arrivals from Earth, for whose benefit and assistance the Corals are specially held, spiritual restrictions arbitrarily forced upon an inquiring mind with a view of preventing it from overstepping dogmatic limits, produce upon the soul a disfigurement in growth as tangible and real as if they were surgical appliances purposely designed to effect such horrible shapes, and the Great Father in his all-embracing provision has designed this process of restoration that such oppressed and struggling souls should be at once restored to their normal condition and enter upon the immortal life free from the disabilities under which they have hitherto labored. Further, let it not be supposed that I am seeking to create a poetic fiction, for which purpose I allow my fancy to roam in search of novelties or situations. Truth is far more strange than any such ideal the mind could frame, and in this record I am satisfied to state the simple facts of God's eternal law, as I have found, and you will find by and by. My descriptions may jar upon your senses by their seemingly vulgar materiality. They may even cause a shock by what appears a coarse portrayal of, and as being antagonistic to, your cherished conception of the nature of this life. For that I cannot hold myself responsible. My attempt is to translate into Earth's prosaic vocabulary, so far as circumstances and means will allow, some slight idea of the realities and truths to be found in the poem and the music of this after life. If the result is but a thick and guttural jargon, void of melody, and disappointing to your hopes, blame me not. The extent of my desire is but to indicate a very brief outline of what the picture might be if the facilities were at my disposal, but that outline is true to scale, as you yourself will find it one day by experience. Should you attempt to re-translate my record from the physical into the spiritual, that you may comprehend the truth as I behold it, let me offer one suggestion, by attention to which at least half your difficulty will be cleared away. Death works one change, and it is this: in the process of dissolution everything is altered except yourself. Old things pass away and all things become new, but you will remain unmoved, unchanged, as the one world makes its exit and another its entrance in the theater of your life. This transformation is effected in the twinkling of an eye when the wand of the magician, death, is waved. The material will fade away like the baseless fabric of a vision ever after to appear as a vague and shadowy substance which must be sought for and be but dimly visible to the newly acquired state, while that world upon whose eternal shores your feet will rest, will leap from the realm of vision into a solid and startling reality, having foundations which never can be removed since they are laid deep down in the bosom of infinity, and whose inhabitants have solved the birth pangs of immortality. Bear this in mind, and read the following pages in the light of this suggestion, then you will understand why I have not hesitated to use that language, however unworthy for the other reasons, which conveys to you the idea that the scenes among which I move are, to me at least, as real and solid as the earth at present appears to you. Just another thought which offers food for meditation and reflection and may help to remove the impression that my statement of spiritual deformity is erroneous and imaginative. Parental profligacy, immorality, ignorance, accident, and a hundred other pre-natal influences produce physical and mental distortions in a child. Why then should it be illogical to assert that in like manner, spiritual errors, unnatural ideas, and bigoted restrictions, generate corresponding malformations and disfigurements in the soul, when it is set free from the flesh in which its shape and lineaments have been molded. Whether you may be able to satisfy yourself on the reasonableness of this point or not, the fact remains the same, and the time is not far distant when you will recognize its truth and appreciate the justice of the law by which it is governed. Be not deceived. The diseases of the soul resulting from personal sin are only removed and cured by slow and painful processes, but the unavoidable defects caused by others' sin or force of circumstances. Have a speedy rectification in such quarrels as that to which I draw your attention. But to return to my digression. Very narrowly did I watch the Assyrian as he applied himself to the removal of those torturing restrictions. At the first, I must confess, it appeared to be a useless labor of love upon which he was engaged, since there was scarcely an indication of life remaining in the sufferer. Presently, however, she gave evident signs that she was still sensible to the pain they caused, but even then I thought it would be greater kindness to let her die in peace rather than disturb her when too late to save, for in that moment of sympathy I had forgotten that it was impossible for her to die any more, since death itself was dead. With more tender care than a mother could have shown to an ailing child, the soft and gentle hands of that physician loosed and threw aside each bond, until at length the last was taken away and she lay at perfect liberty. She felt the freedom, and, glad to make an effort to use it, endeavored, with considerable success, to turn, yawned, and stretched out her arms. Then finding that all restraint was gone, she finally straightened herself upon the couch, and rolling over fell at once into an easy and refreshing sleep. The whole movement was the spontaneous action of a person who, waking from a troubled dream before sufficient rest had been obtained, and feeling the terror of the nightmare broken at once sinks back again to sleep without fully being roused to consciousness. With what interest and sympathy Siams watched her progress can better be imagined than described, until she lay in that quiet and comfortable repose to which she had hitherto been a stranger. Then he was satisfied and turned to give his attention to the next case. All my powers of observation were attracted to the one individual. The further work of liberation would be more or less a repetition of what had already been accomplished, and as there was much I could not understand, I judged a fitting opportunity had arrived to seek some explanation. Therefore, turning to my companion, I asked, "Will you explain what these bonds are, and how such deformities are possible here?" "I have no doubt," he replied, "but that this service is full of wonder and amazement to you. It must of necessity be so, until you grow familiar with our law and mode of existence, until you learn how scrupulously this life is a corollary of the one you leave behind. Hypocrisy, sham and cant are masks which are torn off as you come through the mists, and the real man, whether base or noble, stands undisguised, able to read and to be read of all men. With us no subterfuge is available for the concealment of unpleasant deformity, no matter whether it arises from your own sin or the neglect and criminality of another. Everything is known. To the practiced eyes of Siams, Kushner, and thousands of such ministers engaged in their noble work, the real author and source of every such malformation can be told at a glance, and by an inexorable law, impossible to evade, the penalty and punishment of every wrong falls upon the offender. In this you will see there is a balancing of accounts and a righteous retribution for the deeds done in the body. It is a sad mistake to say that death levels all men, and that this life is a new one, while the record of the old one has been wiped out with a sponge of death. All life is a continuation of that which had gone before, and, entering here, you have but turned over the page to commence another chapter. The story and plot are the same. In this you will find that the mistakes of the past are rectified, overdue accounts have to be settled, and compensation awarded to those who have unjustly suffered. Men are here weighed in the balances of God, appraised by a valuer whose judgment is righteous, and against whose verdict there is no appeal but that of repentance. You will find no bribery and corruption. Everything is sternly real, all men and things are just what they appear to be. The restrictions binding these friends have been worn in violence to their better judgment, but lacking power to conquer the forces opposed to them, they have become victims of circumstances, and have passed their lives in an irksome bondage, being dominated by wills and usages they could not successfully resist. If they had given a ready consent to custom and dogma, followed with unquestioning faith where others led, and been content to crush the right to think, they would have developed the required littleness of soul, without necessity to apply restraint. But they recognized the God within, and refused to still the voice calling them to newer, nobler, higher duties, for the welfare of their kind. Their prophetic utterances were dangerous to a craft, Hence, the gag must be applied. Their eyes saw visions of coming glory for the weary and oppressed, therefore, their sight must be distorted, lest the interests of a class be endangered. The intelligent vigor of the child proclaimed a leader in the man, and church and dogma forged letters to cripple his power, and force the noble stature of the giant into the contortions of the dwarf. You can see it was a battle to the death. Noble lives have been hindered from work, wasted, yea worse, for whereas they were ordained for construction and deliverance, being forcibly tampered with they have been perverted by party bigotry, and compelled to struggle for existence instead of scattering the blessings they were designed to carry to their fellows. The result is to be seen in the wrecks which lie before us. Wasted opportunities, wasted intellects, wasted lives. For all these things those who are responsible must be brought to judgment. Guilt must be righteously punished, while the excess of pain which the victim has endured must receive its legitimate compensation. With the punishment we have nothing to do. The natural law of this life is fully adequate to that, and every guilty soul will reap the just harvest of the seed he has sown. It is that we may take part in the compensation that we are here. Justice demands that an instant liberation shall be given from those bonds, and life must be lavished upon the sufferers until we have helped to build up and invigorate their souls. Then each one shall reach the full development for which it was designed and for which it wept and struggled, but was prevented by action of oppressors. But where do we find mercy and forgiveness in the administration of such inexorable justice? I asked. Every attribute of God has its legitimate sphere of operation, he replied, and the inviolate maintenance of each in its appointed order is essential to the continuance of the Almighty and all-wise perfection of our Father. But it is impossible for any one of these to usurp the jurisdiction of another. Suppose, for a moment, that mercy was allowed to withstand justice and prevail in any single instance. The immediate result would be an injustice, since to show mercy to the offender would be an injustice to the offended, unless, in turn, you show him mercy too. Carry this to its logical sequence and you will be compelled to abolish justice in favor of mercy, in which case punishment and retribution would become an impossibility, law would be a dead letter, and sin, freed from fear or restraint, would revel in its license. But when we see the working of the attributes of God according to his divinely appointed plan, we find how infinitely wise has been the adaptation to the necessities of the human family in its development. Take those to which you have referred, mercy, justice, and forgiveness. Mercy operates on earth, where patience, forbearance, and long suffering are so much needed during the early stages of the conscious existence of the soul. Imagine the catastrophe and disaster which would ensue if unerring justice was enthroned at such a crisis in life's history. Would there be any subsequent immortality to record? Unconscious, practically, of his whence and whither, an untutored experimentalist as to his powers and capabilities, failure and mistake, the law by which he shall develop and learn to understand himself, uncertain if it be right to gratify even the most ardent of his longings, filled with fear and trembling at the forces surrounding him, a volume of nature before him of nature of whose hieroglyphics he is ignorant, though called upon to read, himself the most profound mystery among the million other problems. Under such circumstances, how often would earth be swept clear of man if justice was applied to every transgression of the law, that justice which is perfect as its framer? No. This attribute cannot be applied to such an undeveloped condition. What man could be found wild enough to imagine that it is? Is not rather the absence of justice so manifest as to be used for an argument against the existence of a God, while it has become a proverb among the nations that villainy is the heir to fortune, but honesty marries miss? Oppression, tyranny and persecution are rampant. That might is right is the universal motto practically both of politics and religion. The affluent and wealthy are the honored of the nations, the poor and needy, the curse and bane. Is this right, you will ask me, and I reply, 1,000 times no. But even the injustice of man is not strong enough to cause God to change the action of his attributes, and substitute justice for mercy upon the earth. This universal custom is wrong, and man has gained enough knowledge to know that it is so, but God is long suffering that the oppressor may be able to redeem himself before he is brought into judgment. Mercy pleads, while hope of restitution remains, but once let the law take hold of the offender, and the issue passes from the court of mercy to justice.